woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, North Bay Fast and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe, Ricky on the board. SB Futures down 55. Yeah, 55, not good. NASDAQ Futures down 254. Regional bank worries fuel market sell-off pretty much worldwide. We have Professor Kevin.
Yes.
How you doing, bud?
Good morning.
Maybe you know some of these places. The big concern yesterday was U.S. firms Zions and Western Alliance disclosed bad loans, adding to pre-existing concerns about loose lending practices. Well, Kevin and I are going to talk about that. Not so sure the lending was so loose in a lot of these cases when the loan was given. Maybe things have changed. Over in Japan, there was a couple of Jamie Dimon was talking the other day that there was a bankruptcy of two auto-related firms this year, which prompted a call from J.P. Morgan boss Jamie Dimon. When you see one cockroach, there are probably more. How's that for a comment?
That's probably accurate in many ways.
Yeah, in European trade, the regional stocks banking index fell almost 3% Friday. Germany's Deutsche Bank fell by 6.9%. British banking giant Barclays was down 5.4%. So those are real numbers. These ones I don't know. Maybe Kevin knows. Asia-Pacific region also faltered over the course of the trading day. Japanese financial companies with exposure to U.S. markets were particularly hard hit, with lender Mizuno Financial Group falling by 4%, while insurers Sompo Holdings and Tokio TOKIO, not YO, Marine lost 4.7%. Hong Kong-listed shares of HSBC retreated 2%. Zions Bank Corp yesterday lost more than 13%. Western Alliance Bank Corp dropped more than 10%. Spider Regional Banking Index dropped almost 6%. That's a big move. So I guess the question there is, and also we've got this kind of route going in Bitcoin as well. As one of the people here, our yesterday's producer, Jimmy, pointed out to us, Bitcoin's lost more value in the last week than the entire value lost in the 29 crash. Of course, dollars were different back then, but still, it's a number that I'll take a look at.
Good way to say it.
Yeah, obviously, but it's down 3,400 today. So Bitcoin is 104,000, which is still, by historical standards, pretty high. But I think it hit 126 earlier in the month, Kevin, something like that. So that's somewhat of a drop. What do you make of this? How do banks get to the point where they have to make an announcement, where they have to... I confess, out of all the stuff I know something about in the industry, trying to value banks and their loan portfolios from the information I get, meaning the investing public gets, is extremely difficult. These ratios where you go book to loan and book to this, and if you ask me to value a bank, I'd say you might as well have my old dog Scruff do it. I mean, I don't know how to do it, but... Kevin, can you lend us some wisdom here?
You want me to be a lender too, huh?
Well, I'm just saying, how do you value these guys? How do you know what they have? How do you know they could have given the world's best loan to somebody 2 years ago, and all of a sudden, why would it surprise us? I think you and I talked last Friday a little bit, or was it Wednesday, when the average price of a car is now $50,000, and we've been reporting for, what, 3 years that the amount of car loans that are going into default. Why is it a shock when two companies earlier in the year are issuing car loans have a problem? Why is that a flash, Gordon?
Well, the question is, are they making, are they bundling them up into big packages of loans too? And who's buying them and who's selling them? But you want to know how to see what's going on in the bank? You have to start looking at the provision for loan loss reserve, because that precedes loan write-offs. They see it coming. The old expression in banking, of course, is that the loan was good when I made it.
But didn't the people yesterday, isn't that what they just did? They raised their provision for loan loss reserve, because how would I have known about it on Monday?
You wouldn't know until you see the earnings report.
Well, I mean, somehow or other, they made the announcement yesterday, and I don't think it was an earnings thing. I think they just came out between earnings.
Okay, so then, yeah, if they're doing an extra provision, that means they've recognized bad loans, or they had an audit, and their examiners told them that they had to increase the provision.
But, I mean, there's no way for you and I to know until that happens, I guess is my question.
No, not really. I mean, it's inside information, so you're probably not going to get it.
Well, hence why I kind of stay away from banks. But, do you think if one or two of the regional banks have problems, you can be like the Jamie Dimon, it's a cockroach all over?
Well, yeah, you will have your rogues that that go off and they do crazy things. There are such banks. I remember one of my employers in my banking days had the reputation that if you can't get the loan done anywhere else, take it to them, they'll do it. Because they were totally about about revenue with no regard to quality, and it wound up biting them.
All comes together, Kevin. All the stuff we all talk about, seeming like every day it's the same subject. If somebody comes into Kevin's bank, and I keep asking Kevin this because he's worked in banks, he knows more about banks than anybody else on the show. Somebody walks in and they say, I'll use an example we use all the time. I'm Da Bears, and I want to buy, or I'm Buffalo, the guy on Wednesday, and I want to get a loan for a football stadium, and I'm going to put down there either, here's the loan, I want this kind of money, by the way, 80,000 people are going to pay, this is an exaggeration, $25,000 a seat for a seat license, in 10 years, the ticket prices are going to be $1,000 and not $100. It's another exaggeration. And you get this thing and they want this loan. Now, do you have your own, I guess the term economist, go through this and say, all these assumptions pretty much suck? Or they must be pretty good. They're coming from a good... I mean, how do you... Their view of the future just always, might be different than yours.
Loans like that always go to a loan committee so that you get a lot of eyes on it. It's senior level leadership. And so a lot of people have to buy into the stupidity.
Well, but it just
or not. I mean, they may sign off on it, and it winds up being a really good deal for them. But anything of that size is going to loan committee, and the loan committee is going to either say thumbs up or thumbs down.
But the question I'm trying to ask here, very very clumsily, by the way, is: does the bank in general? Does everybody have their view of the economic future of the country, the city, the state, and when somebody comes in with a loan, do they make it match up to theirs? In other words, if somebody comes in and says, I want a loan for downtown Chicago in 2035, it's going to be the bustling area it was 20 years ago, and somehow or another, all these projects have to have some kind of a view of what the world's going to be like 5 or 10 years from now if it's a 10-year loan. Does the bank have an overriding view? I mean, if you listen to Russell, we've been talking for how long, Kevin, around, sure, there's all kinds of problems in credit card loans, or car loans, or car repair loans. There's stuff in downtown Chicago real estate. There's stuff in China. Somehow or another, these loan losses have not popped out anywhere. And yet here, all of a sudden, now a few are starting to pop out. But just in general, somebody says, I think economic growth is going to be 5%. Man, you know, who's ever in charge of the state, the city, the country, they got it all right. You know, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's going to be 5Y5 to the, out the ass. Everybody's going to be this or that. And you won't believe this world 10 years from now. Does the bank have their opinion of growth and say, wait a minute, buddy, what are you smoking? Or something like that. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Everybody has their own economic view of the future. How does the bank match theirs up with the clients? Or am I saying the wrong thing here?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on the size of the bank, but a large bank is going to have its own team of economists. And so they're going to be the ones predicting the future.
Okay. So if you and I want a loan on a downtown Chicago building saying everything's going to be rosy 5 years from now, they're going to go, wait a minute, get away from the gummy store or something.
Yeah, well, JPM's going to have their people, but on the other hand, if you take it to a regional bank, you know, most regional banks would not be able to bite that off, but they may be able to organize a syndication on it where they spread the ownership of the loan amongst 10, 12, 15 other banks. Then, you know, you may be able to convince them to do it. The problem with syndication loans is, well, the problem for a lot of people is first ones to recognize it's going bad and get out and sell their stock, their share of it, they're going to be okay. But if you're not one of the first ones to recognize something's going south, then you're going to wind up eating it. You're going to eat a big number.
Is that, if you and I wanted to start a bank, and well, years ago, Kevin, one of the guys wanted to do that, you could actually start a bank, you know, I'm talking probably in the year 2000 with $1.5 million, if you had somebody who knew how to do it. I mean, it wasn't a high capital thing. And if you were somewhere like a storefront near a train station, because a couple of people did this on the south side, you end up with a lot of deposits, especially if maybe their favorite bank just was bought and you grabbed a couple of those tellers. The first thing you do, you don't necessarily have an auto loan department or anything. Isn't that what you do, is you buy into syndicated loans of other places or just invest in the government? Isn't that what you do as your first step?
Or do treasuries, or you do mortgage-backed securities, or you do whatever. A lot of people got in a lot of trouble in the early 2000s investing in mortgage-backed securities, which was really just a way of saying, I'm going to fuel the mortgage market, but I'm not going to write the paper myself.
How long, how big do you have to grow up before you start giving, like, your own loans? Where you'll give out, they don't do too many car loans anymore, but... where you'll actually take a few buildings in the neighborhood and give a mortgage on them and stuff. Is it, you got to be way bigger than the storefront.
Yeah, the credit unions will still do car loans. They tend to, do things on behalf of their members, so they're pretty good. It isn't the car loans, it isn't the, most of the home improvement loans or anything. Those aren't what they choke on. It is almost inevitably commercial real estate loans that really investing in the wrong packages. Like I said, there were a whole lot of SNLs as an example in the early 2000s. And they kept saying, we want our loan portfolio, or we want our balance sheet to resemble a commercial bank, not an SNL. So they were trying to gear up the commercial lending function, and of course there's only a finite number of them that can be made, and they were not having a lot of success. And they said, well, we can't have all this capital that we have designated for that tied up into nothing. So they bought a ton of mortgage backed securities and wound up having a balance sheet that looked just like an SNL again.
Well. But how much, this is a very general question, but when they say a loan forecloses, would a loan on, 175 West Jackson, where, 20 years ago or 15 years ago, and these guys came in here with all this money and did all these improvements, and you made the loan, and the people had 40 or 50 million in the place or more plus improvements, and you loaned them, 100 for the rest or something, and all of a sudden the place, the whole south loop here looks like, you know, the part that goes over the fence last. Was that necessarily a bad loan, or just nobody figured out that the exchanges were going to close and COVID was going to happen and whatever?
I would say individually, no, but when they your risk is what happens to the whole commercial real estate market downtown. If you decide you're going to shut it, lock everything up for an over response to a global pandemic, then you've just taken the whole damn market down, and it never came back the same way because it was such a severe shock, and for a substantial amount of time, then you know, then there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that is similar to what happened when you know, in 2007 and 8, is it wasn't that all of those mortgages as individual loans were so bad, or that the quantity of them at least was so bad, or in lesser quantity wasn't so bad, but everybody just kept making them. You know, no down payment loans, balloons, don't worry about it, you'll get to refinance in a few years, let's just get you in the home, and all of that stuff is going on. And then all of a sudden, what do? We run fuel prices up over, you know, where gas was over $4 a gallon, which may not make a lot of people in the Chicago area blink now, even though it's lower at the moment. It may not make everybody blink now, but it was catastrophic at the time. And all of a sudden, you had a slowdown of economic activity of very large proportions. A lot of people couldn't, you know, were not making money because their shipping costs were too high and they were working on tight margins as it was. So a lot of people started to get laid off. And now everybody who was told, don't worry, it's a five-year balloon, you can refinance, all of a sudden they didn't have jobs. No, they couldn't refinance. And they couldn't pay. And so they, you know, they walked away. And so, you know, the industry in general had repossessed so much property. And that's all non-earning assets. It's not like, you know, they still have an asset on their books, and not, you know, they traded the loan for the asset, but the asset was losing value because the market was flooded for it. And on top of that, it sits there on your balance sheet. You don't get interest on that. Even if you wind up getting back the full value of the home that you repossessed 6 months later or something like that, that's 6 months of interest you didn't earn.
Well, the one of these days, Kevin, I don't think I'm ever going to Australia, but if I did, 16 hours on the plane, I would grab myself a, if I could find one, a serious book on how all that unfolded. Because, you know, we were, at the time, you know, we were in the middle of it, trade for people and so forth, and actually, we ended up all right for everybody. We didn't lose that much, but the, you know, all right's a relative term. It wasn't like we got short and made money on it, but we at least protected everybody to the best we could. But everybody talks. It's not really a political end of the spectrum, but it's everybody points their finger at the. You know, we had a lady that came out to dinner with us, and somebody brought with was a stewardess. She had four houses she was flipping and going. And, you know, and she had made all kinds of dough, and there were people that were involved, and I'm not going to debate the part about maybe there should have been a little bit more down payment on some of these houses, but there were an awful lot of people that paid the 20% down and still got clobbered. And it was their entire nest egg from their parents or whatever they earned. And that's why that recession was so brutal. It was a balance sheet. You stripped 20% of the equity out of people's houses. It might have been the bank. It might have been them. It probably was them. But
how many people were underwater? How many people had
had
a $200,000 home and a $180,000 mortgage, and all of a sudden the house is worth $150,000?
Well, I'm saying a lot of people had $160,000 mortgage, and it was their whole $40,000.
Pardon?
I'm saying a lot of people had, I'll use the term, the regular mortgage, where they put $40,000 down, and now it's worth $150,000, and their whole $40,000's gone.
Yeah.
Just a question of who?
And they don't have a job, and they can't sell it for enough to pay off the mortgage. And so, you know, because the market's just totally gone in the dumper. And, you know, imagine what it was like where I live. And Elkhart County has diversified the economy somewhat, but it's still driven by the big dogs, the big dog RV manufacturers. But imagine when the fuel prices ran up, what happened to the RVs, RV sales, and boat sales. You know, it was too expensive to operate them.
But how come?
I live on water. Nobody was on the water that summer in 2008. It was just too expensive.
Well, you were there on your kayak going back and forth doing laps.
Yeah, well, you know, yes, I was, but they don't cost $4 a gallon or $4.50 a gallon to propel.
Plus, you'd have to worry about somebody buzzing by you and dunking your ass.
Well, yeah, I didn't have to worry about that, and I did have a mobile pet grooming business where everybody was, you know, my clients were calling me up and saying, "We love what your groomers do, but you know what, we can't afford you anymore. You know, it's the premium price they paid to have a van pull up, and that little Fifi got the bath and haircut at her in her driveway." That premium price was no longer affordable. They said, "We just got laid off. We have to conserve. We're, you know, Fifi's getting her haircut at the PetSmart now."
The part that I never really searched
it hurt far me. It hurt me personally.
Yeah.
But it was, and a lot of people ran into that. And you know, I'm sitting here at a time when fuel is my other than personnel, other than paying groomers. Fuel was my next biggest cost, and you know, I'm sitting here thinking I need to have a surcharge for fuel because it's so expensive, and yet I have customers who can't afford to pay it. You know, they can't afford to pay extra, they can't afford to pay the base fee anymore. So there were a whole lot of businesses that were in that mode, and therefore Elkhart County ran up to a 20.5 unemployment rate.
Well, I never, even though they had, you know, the kind of the bozo movie about it, Wall Street, I think, Kevin, you and I could both chart out when something like that happens, what happens to the individual sort of person. What I never could quite figure out is how the Fed or how the government, whoever the hell was in charge, I don't remember, it was Bush, right? And then no, Bush, Obama, slash somewhere in there,
I think Bush, it was Obama moved in, won the 2008 election.
Yeah.
So he started in 2009.
But the money that was flying in from Japan, I mean, if you just ask yourself, okay, mortgage rates for what? Let's say 6.5%, which is, you know, within a Scotia normal. I mean, over when I say historically normal. So they weren't that big of a deal. It wasn't like they were 15 where you couldn't wait to put money in there and invest because you're getting this outsized thing. And yet, what you're talking about and what everybody really talks about when they talk about that era was the individual person and their trials and tribulations, which, by the way, you eloquently just did. The weird part, though, Kevin, is these mortgage, package mortgage things, you wouldn't think that people would be racing down the block to buy a 6.5% return. And yet, somehow or another, some people, not you and I, or not any of the listeners, maybe we got a couple of listeners, were borrowing this money in Japan at 1% and investing it here. So you and I, even you and I, can make a real lot of dough if we can borrow like $20 million at 1% and put it in something else at 6.5%. You know, 5% of $20 million, even you and I can probably play a little golf on $1 million a year. At least back then we could. A
couple nice nights out.
Yeah, a couple nice nights out. I remember some individual articles that, of course, I didn't keep. Back at the time, there was a guy from Hong Kong, an economist. It was blasphemy here, right? He said that he thought there were $35 of leverage on every dollar of actual mortgage. And I read that and I go, how in the God's name could that be? And then one of the first place to go belly up, I think it was a joint out of Southside, out of Britain. It had the name Barclays, but it wasn't Barclays Bank. It was something they had tossed off their balance sheet or whatever. It carried the name, but it wasn't. And sure enough, they talked about the losses in the bank, and the losses were 35 times what anybody thought they would be. It was the exact number this guy had. So, and I went to a know, once in a while we go out and meet clients, I mean, whenever I can. I meet this, and you can maybe tell me about this. So this guy, he lives way to hell northwest, right? So I go meet him, and he's bringing his wife with. Okay, it's, you know, you always want that to happen, by the way, because you want to be able, if you're talking about investments, you would like to have both people there. Well, he brings her with, and let's just say, Kevin, she's an unusually good-looking lady, to the point where you're like, where did he find her kind of thing? You know, why isn't she in a movie? And so we're sitting there, you know, BSing what's the place where you get the real high-end bread and stuff, Panera Bread. We're sitting in there, and I said to her, by the way, what do you do for a living? And she says, well, I just got fired. And my ears perk up going, who the hell would fire her, right? You know, is that such a weird male reaction? And she goes, oh, yeah, I work for this mortgage firm, and this is like 3 months before this all happened, before we knew it happened. And she goes, yeah, I work for this mortgage firm, and we just all got laid off. And I go, really? She goes, yeah, we used to make so much dough, we would give out mortgages and we'd get, you know, say $5 million worth of mortgages at 6.5% or whatever. Somebody come by and buy them from us at 106% of the value of the mortgage. I looked at her and I said, say what? She goes, yeah, if we had $3 million for a mortgage, somebody come and pay us $3,180,000 for the mortgage. This is after we stole as much as we could on appraisals and all the other stuff. And I'm sitting there going, I couldn't even process it, Kevin. I have no idea how that even... And she goes, when it gets to the next level, they pay even more. There was such a demand for this stuff. The classic one that blew up, was it Goldman Sachs or somebody? There weren't any mortgages in it. It was artificially put together because there weren't enough mortgages to meet the demand of the mortgage portfolios. And to this day, I cannot imagine, even with people borrowing money in Japan, how that happened. I mean, if somebody wrote a book on it, I want to read it. But it's...
You had non-bank companies in there, putting them together too. I think Nationwide was a big one, but there were a few others. So yeah, there was a lot of places to devastate the economy. And the question, Tom, is how did we get there in the first place? And I have always said the roots of it go back to the 1970s.
Oh yeah,
and this started with what was the act? It was a Carter era.
We went off the gold standard in '68. That was Nixon.
Mortgage market out of whack. It was the It was designed to prevent redlining.
Right.
So redlining was just a matter of lenders would take a map, draw a red line around all the bad areas, and say we won't make loans there, too risky. And
Chicago was rife with that.
Money Reinvestment Act is what it was. So CRA had good intentions, because if you would not loan to a disadvantaged area, there was no way it was ever going to get improved. And basically what it said, among other things, is banks have to serve the communities where they exist. So if you were a First Chicago in the day, and you had branches all over the city, that meant you had to be willing to make loans all over the city, every place where you had a branch. If you were a local bank or a suburban bank, then you had to serve your suburbia location, but you didn't have to serve everything. Well, that went on for a while like it did, but if you fast forward to the Carter administration, they really wanted to spur home ownership. So they rewrote the Carter's Treasury Department rewrote the exam requirements for CRA audit, and they made it much more of a commitment to buying loans. And on top of that, it was also bank merger mania time. So banks were getting acquired, and every community organization would immediately file a protest if a bank was acquired to prevent the acquisition from going through, unless the bank paid a bribe, and the bribe would be, I'm going to put this many $1 million into community investment. In other words, I'm going to make this many loans in certain parts of the community, and then they would back off and they would get it. So now, now we had this whole thing about, we have to make loans to a lower part of the income strata, not necessarily to poor people, but to lower income people. And so all of a sudden we were starting to do loans in volume, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were signing off on purchasing all of it. So that was no problem. And next thing you know, every bank has a subprime mortgage lending subsidiary, and everybody who ever made a loan is starting up their own subprime mortgage lending operation, because they know that it was really easy to get like Fannie Mae to sign off on it, and they take the loan off their hands.
Okay, we're going to go to break, but hey, think on break, like you always do. How much of that mess was caused by, at the same time, all of savings and loans, which was their job, and is into invest in mortgages in their area, were essentially going out of business? Because there had to be some overlap there, because they were better at it than the banks, I think.
They weren't going out of business. They were being acquired by commercial banks.
Well,
they could convert them from a sleepy 7 or 8% ROE to a 15 to 20% ROE.
I'm talking about the Volcker era, where I think he put them out of business on purpose, where they were borrowing, they were paying 10% for money when the mortgages were 6. That's what put them out of business. Anyway, SB Future, you're talking afterward. I'm talking early on when.
When he put them out of business, they just got redistributed to other financial organizations.
SB Futures down 22, NASDAQ Futures down 134. The big number today is the VIX is pushing 25. Danger, Will Robinson. It was up 20% yesterday. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks and Jocks. Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Out. Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 21. We'll come back a little bit. NASDAQ Futures down 125. Dow Futures only down 55. Again, the numbers yesterday, the VIX was up almost 5 points at one point yesterday, and that's like a real lot. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 440. It's a lot, 1.8%. FTSE down 108, 1.2%, not as bad. And the CAC round is only down 14, so they're not getting bashed at all here. Asia, not so much. Nikkei down 695, 1.4%. Hang Seng down 641, 2.5%, as some banks over there, I think, have exposure here, they think, or some people think that. Who knows if they do or they don't? It's hard to find out. Shanghai down 76, that's a full 2%, 1.95, I guess, rather full. Bonds up 1 basis point, 3.99. So 10 years actually under 4%. The Bund 2.57, Japan 1.64. Oil down 15 cents, 57.31. Ouch, if you're an oil trader. But buying gas, boy, $3 a gallon, not so bad. Brent down 19 cents, 60.87. Natural gas down a penny, 2.92. Foreign exchange, the dollar has been strong, not so much today. The euro is almost back up to 117. 116.9, and then the British pound 134.3. It was in the 133s. You know, we'll also talk to Kevin about these 1%, 1.5% moves almost every other day is a real problem if you're doing stuff overseas, because the money that goes back and forth between dollars and euros and dollars and pounds and stuff absolutely makes the stock market look like kid stuff. So 1% number there is big deal. Here's another issue. We've got Bitcoin down $2,100, 105,967. We mentioned earlier this thing at a high of 126 within the last month. That's a lot of money, because there was like $2 trillion in Bitcoin, or in most of these things. And if they're down 20%, you know, that's $400 billion lost. You know, it was made, and now it's lost. And if you've had them, it's not that big of a deal, I guess. But the fact is, it has happened. Ricky, what do you have for us? Trevi Weather Sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:39 here in Chicago. We're looking at about, give me one second, we're looking at 56 degrees right now with a high of 75. Clouds followed by a brightening sky, breezy and warm. Tonight will be partly cloudy, breezy, and warm as well. Couple of showers late and a low of 63 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 59 degrees right now with a high of 84. Pleasant with plenty of sunshine. Tonight, clear with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, we're looking at 9 minutes. Iman Kennedy from Monroe's. Edens from Lane Cook, 23 minutes. We're looking at Eisenhower from Wolf, 24 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, 18 minutes. And lastly, Stevenson from 24 to the Dan Ryan, 30 minutes. Let's talk about the MLB. Dodgers beat Brewers yesterday, 3-1. And Blue Jays beat Mariners, 8-2. And today we got back-to-back games. Blue Jays at Mariners, 5:08 p.m. and Brewers at Dodgers, 7:38 p.m. Bengals beat Steelers yesterday, 33-31. And this Sunday we have Saints at Bears, 12 p.m. and Packers at Cardinals at 3:25 p.m. Back to you guys.
Kevin, it really is hard to even go through a year by year. It's so long ago, but it has such an effect on what's going on today. To go through like a year by year, almost history of all.
The timeline of how we got there, yeah.
It's, I don't know, it just...
Yeah, you know what, I mean, a lot of people blamed, said, well, we a lot of people took out mortgages that they foolishly couldn't afford later, but, you know, they were coerced. It was tempting to do it, and I would understand why people did it. In fact, you know, I had my... home in Wisconsin leading up to there, and I must have refinanced it. I probably refinanced it twice, and I only had it a few years. So, you know, refis were a big deal too. Rates were low. My undying curiosity is because this was a bubble that was going to burst. It could have burst less severely. It could have been a little bit gentler or not so severe is probably a better way to say it at some point. But what caused all the fuel prices to run up in 2007? What caused that? Because that was the big catalyst that said, uh-oh, everything's going to start falling apart.
Well, I mean...
And I've never had an answer to that.
I don't... When that kind of stuff happens and people blame it on kind of one thing, there's... God, Kevin, we could go through... I'm going to say you can blame the banks and the people getting the mortgages, but for... God bless it. How many years? 100 and some years. The best capital in the country on the balance sheet was U.S. housing, right? Pretty much.
And I'm not blaming the people who took the loans. Not nearly as much. Some of them should have had more sense, I guess. But you know, if someone says I'm going to give you a low rate and a balloon payment, and we'll just refinance it after 3 years or 5 years, and everything will be okay. And then you find out you can't, that wasn't going to go on forever. It just wasn't. But, and I'm saying, you know, fuel prices were a catalyst. They, you know, but how did that happen? What caused that big run up? Because I don't know that it was a big supply issue.
I don't think it was either. But here's, you know, that's one thing about economics. You know, Kevin has been teaching. No, not so much not lately. He's doing one of the
economics. I stay away from economics.
But you wander into it in your classes, as you've told me.
Oh, I teach. Actually, I haven't taught management for a while either, but I do teach management.
Well, when people talk about these kinds of investments, especially, and they used to, when this all happened, and you'd get the. This is not. I'm not supposed to say this. You get the old white guys. Guys that were old and white at the time, they're still white if they're just still alive. I think they're still white. You'd hear this pontification about you shouldn't have bought the house, you should have done this, blah, blah, blah. Simple fact is, for most people, your housing is, I'd say, Kevin, would you agree with this? It's the most unusual thing anybody buys because it's both an investment good and a consumption good. Most of the time, something is one or the other. If you buy a stock, it's an investment good. If you buy a six-pack of Coca-Cola, it's a consumption good, right? The one in the middle is a house because you're living in it, but it's also your biggest investment, correct?
And
so when our parents, I'm not, you know, saying they were the old white guys I'm talking about. When our parents, you know, when my parents, my stepfather and my mother bought the house in St. John Fisher, they paid $18,500 for it. Of course, my mother had the $3,600 she saved up, not my stepfather. So they put it down, and things never turned back. You know, every year you got a raise, every year you got a promotion. And I'm going to say in 2 years, the mortgage was half of one paycheck. And in 9 years, we sold it for 28 or something and moved to a nicer place. But, you know, that's 50% in 9 years, 10 years. And we never looked back. And everybody of that generation, I mean, why do people buy a house? Okay. You foolishly or intelligently find a mate. You end up with a little one running around in your one-bedroom apartment. Okay, you get the two-bedroom apartment. Then you get another little one, and finally the wife or somebody wakes up and says, hey, it's time, right? It you buy your house, the timing of it is not something you economically do necessarily. So the fact is, a lot of people just did the routine thing, bought a house. I mean, my brother has always been, you know, president of PTI Securities, real bright guy, and he's always been a guy, he's an accountant, all right, or a CPA by nature, so he's going to be careful. Well, he waited to buy his house in Beverly. Every year he waited, the house went up more than his raise that he saved. So finally, in the third year, he borrowed a few bucks from my mother, and of course, you know, paid her back with interest, my mother, and he got into the place, and 5 years later, he sold it and made, you know, it went higher. None of it had to do with him being a brilliant investor. It had to do with, it was time. He had to get into something. He had to live someplace. So a lot of people that Kevin's talking about, they bought the house at 235 in 2007, where they got to a median spot. And 2 years later, it's 165. And the weird part was, if their mortgage was 6.5 and the mortgages dropped down to 3, which they did, or 3.5, you couldn't refinance because even though you never missed a payment, it's a new mortgage and now it doesn't appraise, which really sucks, right? So so a lot of those people just walked because somehow the industry did not say, all right, look, we'll cut the rate down to 4 if you can stay, which most people probably could have. And why would somebody leave at the 6.5 number is exactly what Kevin just said. There was all kinds of mayhem in the workplace too. And then you had people before that, Kevin. I remember at Pullman, I'm sure you remember, if you wanted to move, if a company wanted to transfer you, they would buy your house. And all of a sudden, you're transferring, they go, okay, we'll buy it at 165. That's the number. Yeah, but Joe, I just paid 230 for it a year ago. That's your problem.
And it wasn't a transfer. It was you lost your job, and now you need to relocate someplace.
Yep.
And you know, because where was the work in those days? The work was, you know, but places like North Dakota, you know, fracking was starting to explode. So there was a lot of work. All those people in the RV industry that lost their jobs because their companies got shuttered in my area, you know, they would want to up and move and go to work in Texas, in North Dakota, parts of Pennsylvania, except that they had this house that they couldn't sell and get their money back, so they did walk away from it. And it was just, you know, and so now you have a whole industry that has all of this, all these non-earning assets that aren't worth the value of the loan. So they have to write them all down. That's the other thing. You get your examination. You take a home that, you know, you have a $180,000 mortgage on it and it's only worth $150,000. You have to take a $30,000 write down right then, right there.
Okay.
And they were doing that in volume.
Kevin, it seems like in our life, there's always been little trap doors like this, or whatever you want to call them, cliffs, and nobody seems to know it until it happens, even though it should have been damn near obvious if you look back on it. Are we doing it again with this leverage, with the margin loans on the stocks going up $50 billion a month over the last 4? Are we doing it again here? I mean, you watch the market go up and down, and it's going up more and more. It's going up and down more and more. These 2 and 3% moves in a day, they were very rare happenings. And we have people that, you know, that I don't manage all the money for people at PTI. We have people that use our IB platform that are totally on their own, you know, but we monitor what they do. God, Kevin, we've got people that if every down day is like you handed them a hunk of gold. They love it because buy the dip. Every down day is a buying opportunity. And, you know, they're on their own. They've got plenty of money. It's not up to us to, but, you know, these are the people that trade through other, you know, electronic firms, and they trade through ours. And, well, not ours, it's IB that we use. And, the only difference is if they ever have a problem, they can call us. It's kind of hard to call the other online people. But I'm saying there's a mentality there that is worrisome. And yesterday when I saw the VIX go up that much, what that tells me is, and I had a adult beverage with one of the guys that works for one of these firms, the amount of people demanding protection right now, buying puts and doing stuff, these guys are starting to gag a little bit. Because what ends up happening is if people start demanding more and more, the price goes up and up. And I have a lot of clients lately, that, matter of fact, we have some new clients that have stocks that we're trying to protect, which, you know, which we do. And I'm horrified at the price we're paying, Kevin. I mean, the price of puts, the price of insurance is to the roof. And if somebody wants it or needs it, you have to pay it, and you try and defray some of it by selling some calls or doing a repair strategy that maybe you pick the right strike or something. I mean, we try and do that, and we're good at it, but it's real hard right now to defray the cost of this insurance. Now, you ask yourself, does that mean I don't buy it? I don't know about that necessarily. You know, if you walk in to buy the Corvette and it's 100 grand, and you say, well, that's fine. But, Kevin, your insurance is 10 grand a year. Well, that's fine. I just won't buy it. Well, I guess you could go down that road, right? You know, but it's...
Roll them dice, Tom. Roll them.
Yep. Spin. Let me at those things. Let me at the bones. All of this
is interesting, but it's trivial in the scheme of what's important this week. So, because it is USC week.
Yeah. Well, we also had our budgets. Hey, I thought this budget statement wasn't coming out. Who's working and who isn't? CPI didn't come out. The labor didn't come out, but the budget statement came out.
You know, I don't know who's working and who's not.
Well, evidently, it's a little less than last year, only because there's a massive surge in tariff money in September. So actually, there was a surplus in September, which like we never have. But that was all due to tariff money, evidently. Or not all of it, but some of it was due to tariff money. But yeah, what's the story? Why is Southern Cal not ranked? It sure looks to me like they're better than the rankings lead you to believe.
Well, what was it? Stat Monitor or somebody who sends me something every week after Notre Dame games said Irish have a 73% chance of winning the game. It's just based on statistical model. It's not, there's nothing qualitative about it. So, you know, I guess people aren't very impressed with what they've done so far. Maybe that who has been the opponent. Although they did beat up pretty hard on Michigan. I don't know what to tell you. What I do know to tell you is that it's a night game tomorrow, and late afternoon we are scheduled to get thunderstorms. So expect one of those lightning delays.
Game over at 2 in the morning or what?
Would be, yeah. So 7:30 Eastern, so it'd be 6:30 in Chicago.
Well, I have to make sure I get my carcass somewhere where I can watch it. Of course, last week they didn't want me to watch it, but I don't mind listening to radio so much. Well, especially if you're driving. But I think Ryan Harris is pretty cool, the guy, the color guy.
Here's what I'm looking at for their games. They had a nice win against Michigan last week, but so far Southern California has played Missouri State, Georgia Southern, Purdue, Michigan State, neither of which is good. Illinois, they lost that game. And then Michigan. So I guess they're not getting a lot of respect for their record's not getting a lot of respect because of the opponents. Now, we should share, which I think I do every year for the listeners. This was a little excerpt from my mom's eulogy where I describe my first memory of Notre Dame football. And that was 1964, so I was like 10 years old. And Eric Parseghian was in his first year. And the program had been down for quite a few years.
It's so down since Leahy, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's been down since Leahy, isn't it?
I think they had some good years, you know, some decent years under Terry Brennan at the beginning, but then that fell apart. And then Joe Kuharik did not do well. Kuharik, I don't know if he left to become the head coach of the Eagles. I don't think Notre Dame fired him, but I think he left to become head coach of the Eagles before things got too out of hand. They turned it over to Huey DeVore for a year. Huey had been a head coach elsewhere when he was much younger. He was a Notre Dame alum, and he had been like at St. Bonaventure, places like that. But he had twice. He served a one-year interim job at Notre Dame. So 1 year was Leahy's years when Leahy went to be a pilot in the war, and then the other one was the year between Kuharik and Arrow while they were recruiting because I don't think they had a lot of
lead. Aaron was the first coach that wasn't a Notre Dame grad, right?
It might have been, yeah. So Eric comes in, he wins his first 9 games. And they only had a 10-game schedule that year. And they went out to Southern California, and they actually had the lead and were trying to go undefeated. And Southern California came back. Everybody I know who's older and watched the game said they cheated, but okay.
They would never do that.
We got hosed by Pac-10 refs. But I ain't going to worry about that. All I remember about that game, because I didn't watch it, was that afterwards my mother was crying.
That doesn't surprise me.
I have not forgiven those evil bastards for making my mother cry.
This is the end, huh? This is the end of an era. They stopped playing them after this year?
Very well could be, unless they can pull a rabbit out of the hat, yeah.
That's all of these old rivalries are going down.
Southern California's initiative. Notre Dame wants to keep playing.
But the Big Ten is driving that, right?
Well, I don't think the Big Ten is telling them that. It's just that the Big Ten is giving them a lot of games, and so it's just not leaving as much room for their non-conference schedule. You got to leave room for Georgia Southern and Missouri State.
Well, I'm not defending them at all. You know, I'd never do that. But is the time of the game being late in the season? That's the problem. I mean, obviously, they're not going to play Georgia Southern on Thanksgiving weekend, or I don't think. There is a difference. I mean, that's been a very key game for both the Irish and Southern Cal. Traditionally, it's when you play out there, it's Saturday after Thanksgiving. When you play here, it's in the middle of October, right? Middle of the end of October. It's been like that for 70 years.
Yeah.
But I don't think as the season wears on in the Big Ten, don't you play only Big Ten people, pretty much?
Well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, the arrangement has always been with Stanford, or for a long time has been with Stanford and Southern California. And Notre Dame likes going on a road trip for Thanksgiving weekend, so they will play Southern California over Thanksgiving weekend 1 year, and then when they get the home game, that'll be in October. And so if they're playing Southern California on Thanksgiving weekend in Los Angeles, then they'll play Stanford that weekend in October in South Bend, and then they flip them, and then they'll go out to the West Coast and play, play vice versa. They'll play Stanford they'll play Stanford Thanksgiving weekend.
Well, for those who don't know the history of this, recently it's been you want to be out there on Thanksgiving weekend because the Irish recruit out of California. And by the way, it's a way to, instead of having to bring all the people you're trying to recruit from California to South Bend, which you might do once, you get to bring them to that game, right? And have a recruiting visit while you're there. Also, but when it all started, you might say, wow, why didn't anybody pay anything? This is long before there were airplanes. So the train trip from Chicago to Southern Cal, it was what? 2 days and a night. So it was what? 36 hours out there, right? Or 40? So you would leave on the train, probably on Thanksgiving morning. You'd back on the train Saturday night, and you'd probably not have Monday classes, but you're back in class on Tuesday. There's no way that they were going to do that during the rest of the season, right? When the priests were running the place, so they would actually pack stuff up in the dining hall, get on the train because they couldn't afford all the stuff on the way out, and they would go out there and play. It was incredible at the time that anybody would even do something like that. It was actually the first time they went out east and played Army. It was a regional team going that far out to play somebody, and you know that's why the Irish are a national thing, is they were the first people to really travel to play football, weren't they, Kevin? They played Southern Cal.
A lot of road show, yes. That was part of it, too. But I think, you know, one of the big things was, if you go back to, I think it was might have been the Jerry Faust era, the
Holy Roller from Moeller?
Yeah, the Holy Roller from Moeller. They tried to do a Thanksgiving weekend game, and it didn't sell out. And that was back when they had 59,000 seats in the stadium, and to not sell out was, you know, highly unusual.
Not to mention, you didn't have any students, so it really looked empty.
Yeah, a lot of students were gone, everything. So that was part of it. The other part of it is everybody likes the Boondoggle. You can believe, you know, when you're saying I have to take all these athletic department people, well, gee, it's Thanksgiving. They all have to take their families, too. So the traveling party for those games is rather substantial.
Can you imagine the club car and the train in, like, 1930 or something? Good Lord, how much those guys are drinking all the way out there? I do remember the Army trip, though, reading about how they didn't have enough money, so they packed all kinds of lunches and dinners on the train from the dining hall. And they didn't have the budget, but they wanted to make a statement. They wanted to have an East Coast game. They wanted to let everybody know that they were a power. I mean, if you could just...
And the Big Ten wouldn't play them back then.
Yeah. Well, I have an interesting question, and just as we talk about this week, if Carl's already can pile on, just as we talk about the, some would say, ridiculous buyout thing of the guy at Penn State, which is 8-year contract, and they got to pay him what? Well, they got to pay him six more years at $8 million a year plus the rest of this year. So it comes out to what, 49.4 or something?
Yeah, roughly $50 million for him.
So guess what? Guess what the guy signed yesterday in Indiana?
Probably a whole lot of money.
Eight-year contract. I didn't get the number. Same thing. It's like, didn't they read the headline?
Well, I will say this. Let me see if I can find exactly what it is. Yeah, so there is a little bit better than I would have expected for the Franklin buyout. So it has an offset clause regarding the salary of his next job, reducing the buyout. So if he takes another job someplace else, let's just say he may get a major college where it's a complete offset, but more than likely, what if he goes to a Miami of Ohio or Ohio University or something and has a lower salary, then that offsets his buyout amount. There's language that he has to diligently search for other employment, so he can't just say, screw it, I'm not going to, I'm just going to sit and collect. He has to search for other employment, on request, he has to provide updates on his search, including coaching and broadcasting jobs. So that includes broadcasting jobs, too. Which could offset the $49 million buyout amount. It appears to limit any attempt to lowball salary by the new employer.
What if he goes for high school and he's making 60 grand?
You go to Kansas or someplace like that and say, yeah, you only have to pay me $1 million a year because Penn State will pay the rest. You can't do it. So they have language to do that. Now, enforcing it, you know, proving it and enforcing it are interesting challenges, but usually what I've seen is that these college athletic directors, they don't have any terms. It's just, yeah, we had you signed up for 8 years, we got to pay you for 8 years. That's what happened at Notre Dame with Charlie Weiss. And he was collecting a paycheck, you know, even after he lost his job at Kansas.
He was still collecting one from Kansas.
He went and became an offensive coordinator someplace like Florida or someplace like that, and then he got the head coaching job at Kansas for a few years, and all the while he was still getting paid by Notre Dame, and he was getting paid by Notre Dame after he got fired by Kansas.
I also think he was getting paid by Kansas after he got fired by Kansas.
Probably was.
Well,
so at least somebody was a little bit smarter on this one.
Well, what if he just says, I'm the local high school job's open, it pays 75 grand or 100, I'm going to coach there?
Well, maybe that would be a choice he'd make. It's probably not one he's going to make because, you know, these guys are competitive.
I don't know how old he is, but I just, in this world of, if I was doing this stuff, Kevin, and by the way, if I was doing this, I'd have you and Lou with me. I'm going to say that it's not just their performance now. Someday there's going to be a pamphlet written about this Penn State thing. I have this sneaky feeling that a team that was supposed to be that good, that if you all of a sudden put these people together, especially if the athletic director, which a lot of them now have, are peeling these people in off the portal, And I don't know how good the communication is between them and the coach, and you're promising people this, and oh, by the way, you're paying them, and the money is not always coming from you. It's coming from other people, which is even more of a problem. I mean, I can't even imagine, Kevin. Well, suppose a massive high-end, performer, which I've never seen come through us, that, and he wanted to get paid, $1 million at PTI. And I'd go, well, first of all, that's a problem. But what if I had to cobble together, yeah, but I also do, I do sponsorship for this guy. And oh, by the way, this particular fund is willing to pay half of my salary as long as I get a home at PTI. I can't even imagine going with those kinds of complexities where a guy that's essentially my employee, for lack of a better term, even though they don't use that term, is getting paid by three or four other people, and not just me. I don't see how Indiana's coach, he looks to me like he's a pretty damn good coach. How do you guarantee that 3 years from now there's not going to be eight people on the team that either don't get paid by whoever this other guy is supposed to get paid, or are supposed to play and don't, or this guy plays somebody who's getting paid a lot of money because he has to, and all the guys behind him sort of revolt and quit? I don't see how 8 years is a long time in this environment. It could have nothing to do with the coach. This guy at Penn State, there could be five people there that didn't get paid by an outside firm and don't want to play or something. It could be something totally different from him. The demise of that team looks to me like something happened internally. It just seems that way.
Well, it may be that. It may very well be that. And I think, you look at the landscape now, the way that the college football game works.
Or doesn't work, depending.
Or doesn't work, or it's dysfunctional. But whatever you look at, it takes a whole different skill set as a leader to turn it into a team. And I would rate it as similar to what John Calipari used to do at Kentucky. That guy's skill, it wasn't like he was the greatest coach ever, tactically or in any other way, but what he was really good at was taking his annual group of one-and-done players, and if you saw them in December, they were pretty hopeless. They just had no clue as to how to play team basketball, and they didn't do anything complex or anything special. They would just, he would get them to play base offensive basketball, base defensive basketball, just get the fundamentals and pull it together so that they were formidable by the end of the season come tournament time. And that's a different skill set than if you're going to go in and you're saying, it's going to take me 4 years to build up this program and get it the way I want it and start bringing people through the system. And Mike Bray's old mantra was, get old and stay old with his team. And you that's just not happening anymore. So it is a different challenge. And some coaches can adapt to it, and some coaches can't. And some coaches just walk away from it saying, this ain't what I want to do anymore.
Well, Kevin, when I was very, very young, I was an avid reader of, kind of crazy stuff. I love the Hardy Boys. I'm talking third and fourth grade. Well, there was, I don't even know if they're even in print anymore. It was, we talk about a memory. There was a guy who wrote a whole lot of stuff. They were called Chip Hilton Sports Stories. Did you ever read those?
No,
but it was once you got into him, you got kind of addicted because Chip Hilton was the big star, and he and his buddies they all were from a small town. God, I forget the name of the place. In a small town in some state, and they were like the matter of fact, they were very similar. I wonder if the book was even based on him. It was very similar to the Whiz Kids, Lou Boudreaux and that group, where they won all the high school. Football and basketball in high school and baseball, and then they went down to Illinois and did real well down there. It was like four or five guys that went to, was it Thornridge or Thornton, one of the two, in the south suburbs of Chicago. The book must have been sort of almost based on that. Well, anyway, Chip Hilton was a quarterback, and he had all these buddies. One guy was a tackle and a couple ends. And so they do real well in high school, and they go up to state. Well, it turns out, whoever wrote the book, God knows if you even find it. I wouldn't know which one it was out of them. It had to do with the people up at state every one of the other players on the team all had sponsors. And every sponsor was so anxious to talk to the coach to make sure his guy played because they thought his guy was going to be All-American and blah, blah, blah. Well, the problem was the guys that came up from Valley Forge is the name of the town, and just enrolled in the school and essentially walked on, Chip Hilton and his buddies, were better than the other guys. And the entire book was the politics of the whole mess. God, Kevin, it reads like today. It has to be 60 years ago. It reads like today.
Because that's the case anywhere. It's one of the challenges for anybody who's in a leadership position. But it's worse in college sports because everything's a one-year deal, if that.
Yeah.
So, we should bring Carl in, too, because Carl is probably living in the one place where nobody cares the slightest bit about Notre Dame in Southern California.
Well, but he cares about Tennessee.
Well, you know, you'd be right about that not caring. I'll tell you, you know, I was biting my tongue here for the entire first hour. I was biting my tongue. You guys
You draw blood?
Well, you know, I didn't taste anything funny in my mouth, so apparently not. But there's... isn't it interesting how... there's always only one cockroach. Whenever we talk about the markets,
Carl, the reason why you're biting your tongue, we intentionally left you this opening knowing you'd go for it.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that right, Kevin? We gave him this opening.
I didn't do any intentionally.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, that little auto finance company that's writing loans to illegal immigrants who have no right to be here in the United States in the first place, and therefore no right to a cash flow that would allow them to make the payments. If you sell that as a good loan to somebody, you have done something that starts with the letter F. Fraud.
Are these loans on new cars, used cars, or now there's loan
guys? No, we're selling we're giving these loans to illegal immigrants in the construction industry in their $100,000 trucks.
But they're not people that do car repair loans, which is even more bizarre.
Well, we're going to get to that one. Okay. So that was the first one. That was this I think it's called Tricolor or whatever. It was the first one that went kablooey. Okay. So first off, we have that, all right? We have a company that is engaged in an explicitly unlawful transaction because it is making a representation. Now, if you want to do this as a private entity, if you want to put that kind of thing out there as a private entity with your own money, have at it.
Well, it's somebody's money.
Well, okay, but the minute you sell that paper off and represent it as a good credit risk, you have committed fraud. End of conversation. Because that person has no legal right to be here in the U.S. And the premise that they can make the payments is predicated upon them having some statistical probability of being able to make the cash flow.
You can go get the truck and remain
in the country.
But
you can go get the truck.
Well, there's the other problem is that Jose sees his next door neighbor get deported. He gets in the truck and drives it across the border into Mexico. Now you've got 100% loss because you can't even repo the vehicle.
I would find it very hard to believe that with a huge mess with people, $50,000 cars. And the amount of loans, there's 10-year loans now, for God's sake, that the problem is all people driving trucks to Mexico. I think regular people are in trouble.
I didn't say it was all. I said with this one individual firm that blew up. Okay? Now, that's the first hey, man, there's a cockroach.
Well, you know,
Then the next one is this other firm, First Brands, that was a supplier to the O'Reillys and the AutoZones that are all over the place. right?
Oh yeah.
So they're a supply. They're a major supplier into the aftermarket parts industry.
Do they make them or finance them?
I don't think they actually made them. They sourced them and distributed them. Okay. So now the problem with these guys is that they were selling off paper more than once. The paper involved in them, all right, was being sold off more than once.
What do you mean the paper?
Well, all this stuff's financed.
Okay, so you go online and you try and source, you know, there's a huge network of buying stuff from auto parts places and junkyards and everything. So if I go in there and I buy something from a junkyard and it shows up at my place, I guess I could finance that, but most of the time, most people don't, do they, or do they? I don't know.
No, we're not talking about individuals. This is now at the within the corporate supply chain.
Right, so O'Reilly uses them to finance stuff.
O'Reilly uses them to get their parts.
But O'Reilly's still fine. You're saying they're not paying them?
No. O'Reilly's fine, but the company has to pay the suppliers.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, the company doesn't happen to have the $1 billion laying around. All right. So, you know, I mean, most commercial transactions, have some level of credit involved in them somewhere, right? So...
You wouldn't think those would, but yeah, I guess so. Probably.
Well, let's pledge this collateral four times and say that everybody has first line.
All right,
which is basically what is alleged to have happened.
So they're buying all the parts from China or someplace, shipping them to O'Reilly, and all of a sudden they're not getting paid by who? O'Reilly's paying them.
Well, right, exactly. But they pledged the same thing to three different places.
Oh, really?
Loans.
Well, that's interesting.
Well, okay. By the way, that's that F word again, right?
Yeah.
There's that F word again. Okay, now the latest one is that hit these regional banks. Okay, and by the way, not just the regional banks. This thing with First Brands apparently got J.P. Morgan.
That's okay. What Jamie Dimon is. One of the cockroaches.
Yeah, Jamie was saying, those bastards got me. Okay, that's because you weren't paying attention because you wanted the whatever your benchmark was plus the extra 300 basis points that you could get by doing this deal. Therefore, you didn't look too closely, right? Because if you'd look closely, you would have seen it. But you didn't bother verifying anything. Now we got more of these, and these are the ones that hit these regionals. Apparently, this same crap was going on in the CRE space, where these guys were writing paper, claiming that it was first line paper, and it wasn't. It's three and four levels down the stack. There's two other mortgages in front of it. That got found, and all of a sudden, all these regional banks that had bought this crap get hit. Okay, now what is the common element between all of these? Well, it's the same common element, by the way, that was exposed in a recent Senate hearing, all right, when the people started saying, hey, you know what, we've never had a real examination of the safety of vaccines in children across the entire totality of the possible bad outcomes, not just one place or another, but you know, is the kid better off having taken these 16 shots, okay, or not? Well, I think that's a reasonable question, right? So Henry Ford, remember, the same medical system that was publishing data on COVID outcomes early on in the outbreak, using hydroxychloroquine, all right, for everybody that came in the place, they had the ability, of course, to monitor the person because they're sitting in the hospital for any possible bad outcome as a result of heart rhythm dysregulation, which is a known risk of the drug. All right, of course, the drug's been used for lupus for a very long time, and it doesn't seem to kill people when it's used that way. So they had a pretty good reason to believe that they could get away with doing it. So they publish a paper that says that they had about a 50% reduction in mortality if they started giving it to everybody that came into the ER with COVID very early on. Fauci goes after them and basically calls them a bunch of quacks. Okay, now this is arguably one of the best medical systems, probably the best medical system in the southern part of Michigan. They've been around forever, all right? We're not talking about a little organization here. We're talking about the largest single hospital group in southeast Michigan. Well, these same guys back before COVID actually did this study. Retrospective, but they had all the records because they have all the medical records for all the people that come through their affiliated, their hospitals and their affiliated doctor networks and everything else. They've got all this stuff. So they go back and they analyze it. And they find that there is a 250% greater risk, the hazard ratio is 2.5, for any chronic condition among children that took the shots. That's what they find, any chronic condition, all right, including things like asthma, neurodegenerative problems, autoimmune disorders. Now, interestingly enough, they did not find an associative link specifically with autism, which is what, you know, Kennedy's been screaming about forever, right? They did not find that. However, they did find a really serious increase in overall risk. And the system buried the report. It was never published.
Well, that's what we were... But that's what... who's in charge?
Chief.
On any
chief.
Level of I won't even say government, because... We've been talking on the show off and on. We talk about the, and I keep saying it's all the same subject because
yes, it is.
You keep looking at, like, let's stay on the car loan thing for a minute because we'll cover healthcare another time. I always kind of wander in there, but that's okay. But now you look at the the CNBC just 60-day auto loan delinquencies. Hit all-time high. Now, I don't know if it's supposed to be Mayor Johnson, Governor Pritzker, President Trump, Senator O'Neill, or Senator, Carl. Someplace, somewhere, this stuff stuff collides. And you've been talking about this for a while in terms of where, by the way, the VIX we'll talk about, hit 25 yesterday, was up 5 points in one day. But when you look at the median income of $32,000, okay, in 2000, and now it's 48, which has kind of jumped up recently. And you look at the where the hell's the somewhere here is the new car price, or the car price in 2000 versus the car price today, and now we're just over 50 grand. And you see the amount of people that now, if you're going to go anywhere, God help you if you buy a used car, because you can't, the cost of repair is you can't deal with that either. So now the question is, you and I think, are capable. The average new car in 2000 was 22, and now it's 48. All right, so one is up 50%, and one is up 115%. So, you and I are going to sit there and go someplace, somewhere, on some chart that maybe Hal has somewhere, you're going to see going people buying a new car that really, who's telling me that they have somebody, their kid or somebody has a car payment of $750 a month. Well, hell, that's like a lot of dough for a car. And so you and I think, look at this and we go, one of these days, if we get any kind of a pause in hiring, any kind of a pause in anything else, or increases in taxes, read tariffs, we're not supposed to say those are increasing taxes, someplace, somewhere, there's going to be a collision here if there isn't already. Why is it that you and I and the rest of the people are talking on a podcast in the morning and nobody wants to listen to us? Or they want to ignore it, or they absolutely want to ignore it. They're too dumb to see it, or they see it and they don't.
Chief, the problem is, when you get down to it, that the entire thing is a fraud-laced pack of lies. Okay, here's another one. This just hit the wire. I'm looking at it right now. Okay? Although it was published yesterday in the afternoon on CNBC, all right? Jeff Cox is the author, so flame him for it because he deserves it.
Some of the articles that we have cited on the show he wrote, they're pretty good.
Well, this one he should be taken out and strung up for.
What did he say?
No, I'm serious. Literally struck.
I know, but he's one of my the few guys at CNBC I kind of like. What did he do this time?
Well, what he did this time, here is the key point, the first key point. President Donald Trump's tariffs will cost businesses upwards of $1.2 trillion in 2025, with most of the cost being passed to consumers. Now, he cites an analysis from S&P Global. So he's the reporter, but he's not the source. Okay, so I'll be fair to him in that he's the reporter. But because he's the reporter and because he's a journalist, he's also supposed to look at this wee little thing that just showed up that we talk about every month when it comes out, and that is the MTS, which, by the way,
we noted that earlier, and I saved it for you.
Well, Ed, guess what? In the MTS, we have... And September is, of course, the end of the fiscal year, right? So now we got the whole thing, right?
The whole stinking year.
The whole stinking year is in here. And in here we have this line under budget receipts. We have this line called customs duties. Oh, yes, we do. And customs duties, current fiscal year to date, $194.866. This is millions, so that's $195 billion, right? That's a big number. That's pretty good size, right?
Red ink would have been worse had it not been for a massive surge in customs duties.
Okay.
You deny that?
No, I'm about to give you the comparative, because your clown face over at CNBC said that this was over a trillion. By the way, $195 billion. Can't be a trillion, right, to begin with. But over previous year, which, of course, was all Joe Biden, because zero of the previous fiscal year was Trump, right? None of it, right? Was $77 billion. So as a result, the delta is, 120, roughly? 115?
All right, so what's the amount of tariffs are increasing every month in their taxes? The problem is people won't even agree with that.
No, Chief. The problem is that your clown face over at CNBC inflated the amount of actual tax collected, and therefore the amount that can be passed to American consumers by a factor of 10. He lied.
I'm trying to read that part. I haven't found it.
Well, it says $1.2 trillion in 2025. That's the first key point. Tariff cost to companies this year to hit $1.2 trillion. And yet, the MTS, which is the checkbook, all right, or the general ledger, which
I think they're two separate numbers.
They're not two separate numbers. The amount of money collected from tariffs this fiscal year is $195 billion. And it was $77 billion the previous year. That's a delta of about $120.
Okay.
All right. So how can $120 billion end up being 10 times as large?
It's because your president is always talking about the firms are supposed to eat the tariffs. Maybe some of them are actually eating them.
Chief, okay. So here's... All right.
I'm still trying to find the...
No, I'll tell you what I'll tell you what the truth is. Okay, here's the truth. The truth is that I'm a T-shirt importer, okay? And I got hit with a 50-cent tariff on every T-shirt. All right? I import a lot of T-shirts because, you know, I sell a crap ton of them, right? And I got hit with a 50-cent tariff on every one of them.
Where are you seeing the $1.1 trillion for businesses? I'm not seeing that at all.
Do I need to send you the link?
I'm looking right at it. I'm reading the article.
The headline, tariff cost to companies this year to hit $1.2 trillion, with consumers taking most of the hit, S&P says.
I'm looking at the one that says U.S. budget deficits edged lower.
No. I'm citing a different article.
All right.
This is published yesterday at 2 in the afternoon. I updated... yesterday at 2:30, so apparently they changed some words in there somewhere. All right, The cost of terrorism, the firm says that just one-third, this is S&P Global, one-third will be borne by companies, the rest falling on the shoulders of consumers under conservative estimates. But
well, that's about the number we had. We thought they'd eat about a third.
But the total number isn't $1.2 trillion. It's $120 billion.
It says right here, September saw $30 billion in tariff payments, is what you said.
Yeah. September saw $30 billion in tariff payments, and the entire year was $195.
Yeah.
All right, well, guess what? $195 billion, which, by the way, is $120 over what it was during Biden when Biden was president.
Okay.
So it wasn't zero when Biden was president. Tariffs were being collected.
There's other customs duties.
Well, I'm just saying, tariffs were being collected. Okay. $195. Okay. So that's $120 increase. Which is about
the difference. The budget deficit is about that much less this year than last year.
Gee, go figure, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, actually, it's not. But yeah, and I want to go through a little bit more of that too, because there is some really nasty additional numbers in the MTS.
How do they decide what reports are coming out? The ones that look good? I mean, the CPI didn't come out.
Treasury's still open.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, Treasury doesn't shut down. That'd be really cool. If Treasury shuts down, you don't got to pay taxes.
Well, they're accepting IRS checks. Are they sending out refunds?
Well, I would assume they are because, Treasury's open. All right. Although, I don't know. I mean, yeah, EFTPS is open.
Like, I guarantee if you send them a check, they're cashing it.
No, really?
Yeah.
But here's the thing, is that, this report comes out on time, okay, and it's contemporary with this clown's article, all right? So he had absolutely no excuse. He can't say, well, I didn't have that data. Yes, you did.
Well, I'm looking at the article today is every number you gave is the one that's in the article. So I don't know what he put out yesterday. I didn't see that one.
Well, what he put out yesterday was garbage. It intended to drive a political polemic. The tariffs are actually 10 times the size of what they really are, which is malicious.
I would not say that. I don't know. I can't put a number on it, so I would never write it. But the idea that the amount of that goes to the government, which is $30 billion in a month, is the entire cost of this tariff fiasco to all businesses. I think it's got to be way higher than the 30 that ends up at the government.
Well, I'd like to see the accounting on that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's impossible to get. You're saying that the whole tariff fiasco doesn't cost Walmart a dime. It's only the part that goes from the importer to the government.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay, well, then how do you find the number?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the amount of money that gets distributed across the supply chain that is actually tariffs over this fiscal year is $120 billion, in addition to what was being collected before.
Let's put it this way. Some of the articles I've been writing, and who knows, they could all be nasty Democrats, criticizing our wonderful group in North Washington. The fact is, all kinds of people here, and even local papers, have talked about some auto parts people. A lot of people, their prices on getting the stuff they're getting, and they're eating some of it, that it's percolating through the chain. It's causing people a lot of problems. Not just the money that goes to the government.
Well, okay, look. Is it causing people a lot of problems because there's an amount that's being charged? Or is it causing people problems because people are using it as an excuse to jack prices?
Maybe some people are getting their stuff from overseas, and all of a sudden they are higher. So people who aren't getting their stuff from overseas are raising their stuff up. So the person who at the end of the game gets higher prices from somebody who's not even imported. I think that's happening all over the place.
Well, okay, but if that is in fact the case, then you could still buy from overseas and pay the tariff. And the entire point of putting a tariff, well, I don't know about what Trump's point is, but I'm not sure he's, you know.
I'm sure he knows either.
Here's a guy with a 980 SAT score, okay? But the point of doing a tariff, the point of laying one, is to remove the uneconomic distortion between from having that thing, whatever it is, made here in the United States. That is the legitimate purpose of tariffs.
That's your legitimate purpose, and it is legitimate. It has nothing to do with what he's doing.
I didn't say that's why he's doing it. I said the legitimate reason to do it is to take the externality out.
Right.
That you don't want in a society, because it is a bad thing.
I have to always take what Carl says down to the nitty gritty. If somebody takes the factory from your side of the Rio Grande, where you can't pollute into the Rio Grande, and moves it to Mexico and starts dumping crap in the river, Carl's idea, when it's a good one, is you gotta somehow even that up.
Right. What I have always argued is that the correct and appropriate way to use this tool, and we should have been doing it forever, and we didn't because not doing it makes the stock market go up. Okay.
I get it.
But it screws Americans twice. Number one, air, water, land are, the pollution still happens. Putting it over there doesn't make it not happen.
Right.
Okay. That's the first thing. If you're an ascriber to the green nonsense and energy stuff and decarbonization, all that garbage, which, by the way, is garbage, in my opinion.
Well, anyway, what do you say we go to break and we'll take this down to the other level, and I'll try and say a few of the things that I don't think Jeff Cox has a view on it, a number, because I can't figure what the number is, but at least trying to say where the other costs could necessarily be. S&P futures down 6, NASDAQ futures down 70. What'd you think of that jump in the VIX from 20 to 25 yesterday?
I think it was not enough, considering what was how the cockroaches just came running across the floor.
I tell you what, I've been buying some puts for people who want to get, all of a sudden, I'm paying a lot of money. I'm paying a lot of money. And I was talking to some people last night that are in the, what do they call them, the liquidity providers, and they're gagging on stuff people are trying for insurance. I mean, it's starting to be. Anyway, we'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jacks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jacks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Low and OPEC, Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P futures only down 4 now. They were down a lot more earlier. NASDAQ futures only down 62. We've come back away. We've already described that a down move is money in the bank for the buy the dippers. At least they think it is. It has been for quite a while, so we'll see if it stays that way like for another 20 years. I don't know that it will, but one never knows on that. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 348. That's 1.4%. They're the worst. FTSE down 92 point. It's a full 1%. CAC around is actually up 44 cents. The big problem is in the bank stocks, as Carl and I and Kevin have been talking about. Deutsche Bank's down a bunch. European bank stocks across the border down 3%. Because everybody has exposure here, even over in Asia. Nikkei down 695, 1.4%. Hang Seng down 641. That's 2.5%. Shanghai down 76, 2%. Again, we had some trade talks going back and forth yesterday. Trump's going to meet with Putin, then he's going to meet with Zelensky. I mean, it's hopefully he succeeds, because I don't want to see people keep getting shot. But 10-year, 3.9999. So it's actually very little under 4%. Oil down 4 cents, 57.42. That's probably the good news. You can fill up the tank cheap. Gold is up to only 370. It was up a bunch more earlier. Silver down $1.58. These are all off their biggest record move in a while. We have a lot of people involved in that. It's been a very nice week for us. A foreign exchange almost back to 117 on the euro, 116.7 after being under 116. British pound 134. They were down to under 133.3 or something earlier in the week. These 1% moves back and forth and these currencies is a big deal. Crypto down $2,400, 105.701. It's down 21,000 from the high 3 weeks ago. That's a lot. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:39 here in Chicago, 56 degrees right now with a high of 75. Clouds followed by a brightening sky. Tonight will be partly cloudy, breezy, and warm with a couple of showers late and a low of 63 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 59 degrees right now with a high of 84. Pleasant with plenty of sunshine. Tonight will be clear with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Emile Kennedy from Monroe, 16 minutes. Edens from Lane Cook, 30 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 34 minutes. We're looking at 23 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th and inbound Stevenson from 20. 24 to the Dan Ryan, 39 minutes. MLB, Dodgers beat Brewers yesterday 3-1, and Blue Jays beat Mariners 8-2. And today we got Blue Jays and Mariners 5:08 p.m. and Brewers at Dodgers 7:38 p.m. Back to you guys.
The Carl, I guess I'll be real brief here. The number that nobody seems to be able to get, and again, I keep using the same example because it was my final in grad school. That's how long ago this was. You got Mercedes coming over here at $50,000 a car. Their biggest competitor is, say, Cadillac, maybe Lincoln. If you throw a $5,000 tariff on Mercedes. All right, so somebody, if it comes in at $50,000, somebody's got to write a check to the government for $5,000. Importer. Now, Mercedes might say, we don't want our price going up that much. We're gonna eat $2,000 of it. So now it comes over here at 53, not 55. So you're 10%. It comes over here at 48, not 50. So your 10% tariff, instead of being $5,000, is $4,800. We know that check goes to the government, and now the guy here has a price. Now the dealer might eat some of it too. He may or may not. But now you've got the Cadillac, the sneaky mustachioed Bandito Cadillac guy and the Buick guy and the Lincoln guy going, whoa, it looks to me like this Mercedes is up $4,000. And the difference between the two of them was 10 and now it's 14. We can sneak ours up a couple grand and
crank ours up and make the price go up and still keep the differential.
Still keep the differential and maybe Buick. Everybody along the line. Now Cadillac's up. So Chevy goes, okay, we're worth $10,000 less than a Chevy or Cadillac, and now the Cadillac is now 42 instead of 40, so we're going to make the Chevy, you know, 28 instead of 27. Those numbers are very, very hard to come across as to who's doing what.
So
where.
It's basically impossible to
get. And that's one product. Right. So you can imagine millions of them, you know.
Well, but taking those side effects, if you will, which is, you know, kind of sort of what they are, right? I mean, that's, you know.
Unintended consequences, or maybe intended.
Maybe intended consequences. I don't know if it's unintended or not, but, I mean, very clearly, this is a essentially impossible figure to get an accurate read on, because it goes.
And this is one product.
Well, I understand that, but across the economy, it's 100 times worse, right? Because, of course, it's not one product. It's all the products. But my point simply is that this drumbeat that comes out of the business side of the world, okay, which, of course, is what CNBC is, this drumbeat that this is a $1 trillion tax that has been imposed and collected by the Trump administration is a blatant and knowing lie.
Well, their estimate of the numbers the first year is going to be $660 billion coming to them. So if it's coming to them, it wouldn't surprise me that the total cost to everybody totals up to be double that, which would be $1.1 trillion.
Look, you can say that the administration, and guess what? The Trump administration, like every other administration, lies about the positive impact of anything that they do that they say will have a positive
impact. Well, I'm going to say the 660 on the top of it and the start of it is probably going to be more like 350.
According to this, given the number of months in the fiscal year, my guess is it's going to be closer to 200.
Well, $30 billion in September times 12 is 360.
But except that's not how it works.
It's a little bit of a short. It's not 660. Is all my point.
No. Well exactly. Yeah. And it also is. But my guess is because it is uneven. And by the way, Taco Trump always chickens out. You know, they're on, they're off, they're this, they're that, they're, you know, it's
bad. Yeah, how would you like to be the guy calculating this stuff? What, do you get a new sheet every morning?
Well, I you know, that'd be a pain in the ass, right?
Yeah.
You'd earn your money, that's for sure. But that's the thing, is that, so you can't, like, take a look at, you know, he says, well, you know, we're slamming China with 100% tariff, and then 3 weeks later, it's, oh, by the way, it's, you know, it's 16% or it's 30% or whatever it is. You can't take the headline number that these guys throw out there and extrapolate it, because that's not, at least so far, all right? I mean, if I was running the show, I'd say this is the number, this is the, but I would calculate it, as opposed to, you know, pulling a number out of my butthole and say, slamming on the
table.
Well,
but there are people, I mean, some of these numbers, depending on how you want to look at it, Carl, and again, we could talk personally and on the air forever. There was somebody the last, I listened to my News Radio 78. I don't know who these people are. But I don't get the names, but some of them are pretty damn good, especially on like the News Business Hour. And a guy was talking about in the last month, September, they expected, because of tariffs or not, that the average auto price of a new car was up 3.1%. And they thought that the spare parts were up even more than that, 4%, yeah. Whatever. So if you were to take the price of all new cars and say 3%, and the price of God knows the parts, and run them up 4%, if you just did the math on those two numbers, which would be a little sloppy, but what do you think it is? It's huge.
Oh yeah, no, I am not, Chief, don't get me wrong, I'm not arguing that this is, you know, this is why
you and I don't like tariffs, because nobody, not only are they a bad idea, but nobody can figure out the unintended consequences. $50,000 price of the average car just turned that way this week, okay? Now, how much of that do you think has to do with all the different tariffs, parts, and all the other bullshit? I'm going to say at least $2,000.
Yeah, but quite probably. I want to back up a bit.
Yeah.
All right, I want to pull a lens back, because this is the, you know, the conversation, the first part of our time today was essentially going through the fact that we live in a fraud-based economic system and fraud-based political system today, whether we like it or not. The bottom line is,
well, it's getting worse too. It's not just
Course it's getting worse. But by the way, What made it, I would argue that what made it really, really awful, okay, is the official policy of the government after Arthur Anderson that no corporation of significant size and employment is ever going to have anyone go to prison. It is never going to happen. There are going to be no felony criminal charges laid, none prosecuted, and nobody's going to go to jail. We may fine you, but we're not going to throw you in jail. And as a result, you have people doing things that are blatantly felonious, like claiming a loan is a first line when it's not, and they know damn well it's not, okay? And yet they're selling off that paper as being a first lien, which of course has a much higher value than something that's third in line behind two others and has probably got a recovery value of zero if it defaults.
Well, right? Okay, since you brought it up, let me hang for a second. Let me bring back the Arthur Anderson issue. Arthur Anderson was one of the big eight accounting firms. They also had a consulting firm that is now Accenture. But the deal is they, boy, I guess I'll be a little longer here in the tooth, Carl, please, so excuse me. The accounting area never wanted a regulator.
I understand that.
Well, okay, now, let me finish. The securities outfits always have a regulator.
Right.
Exchanges have a regulator. So what the regulator really does, you may think that they regulate. They regulate people like us, PTI Securities, basically up to behind. But for an exchange, they or one of these firms, they get between them and the justice system.
Right.
So if the an exchange or a securities firm gets a huge fine for doing God knows what, or a bank gets a huge fine from their regulator, with the Comptroller of Concurrency or whoever it is, they're not in the Justice Department. It's not a felony.
Right.
Which it should be. But it isn't. So in other words, if somebody on the Florida Seaball, I'm going back 30 years, so it's statute of limitation. If some firm, for instance, came into a crowd and said, what's the market on the 45-50 put spread? And somebody goes, 3.25, 3.125, or 3.25, 3.375, showing my age. And they go, we're going to pay a half. We're going to take half of it. We got 2,000. We'll split the other 1,000 up amongst you schmoes. Okay, the firm just stole 1,000 times 1,250, which is 12,500 bucks the way I count. Now, that and anywhere else in the world is a felony. If they ever would have got caught, they might have gotten a $500 fine and be written up or some crap. There'd be the accounting firms were too stupid to realize this. They wanted no regulators. So when somebody went after Arthur Andersen, it actually ended up in court.
Right.
And it had to do with, and the weird part was, they were convicted. But the rule is, if you are convicted of a felony, you can't do public audits.
Right. That's right.
And by the way,
that's how what it should be.
Okay, but if they had a regulator, they would have just gotten slapped on the fanny. But the weird part was, though, Carl, is that at the end of the day, and this part I think even you has to be somewhat sympathetic with, all the stuff that they were essentially were convicted of destroying documents.
Yeah.
And the weird part was I knew people that were involved in it. They said all the documents were producible from other offices or someplace. And somehow, even though this group destroyed them, the company still had them. So at the end of the day, you might say, okay, those people that did it, tried to do it, they were bad actors, you know, take them out in the street, throw a tomato at them or something. The fact is, thousands and thousands of people got laid off afterward when the place went under. But most people might say, a lot of people seem to have done a lot worse. How many times did Wells Fargo get clobbered and they're still there? The guys are still on the board.
Okay. By the way, why did Wells Fargo get clobbered 100 times and still be there? And the reason is we don't throw anybody in jail for felonies anymore. And by the way, signing up accounts that people didn't ask for. As a way of churning
I'm in the middle.
Customer.
You know, I'm agreeing with you on this. I think you could be the hardest guy in the show to agree with. I agree with you, but somewhere along the line, if that happens, I'd be right with you on this. All the people on the board, $50,000 fine, and you can never be on a board again. I would do stuff like that. I'm with you, but I'm not going to lay off the teller at the Wells Fargo down the block.
All right, fine. You're not. I'll take it a different way. Everybody who's on the board goes to prison for 20 years.
Well, and whatever. Now nothing happens to them. So I'm going to say something.
I understand that. I'm saying that fines don't work. The reason fines don't work and this kind of a ban doesn't work is they're evaded and they're passed on to other people. You can't pass on a prison sentence. You have to serve it. So if you get a prison sentence, you have to serve it. And that's the only.
But you're
thing that
you're also making the track. You're also making the determination that an individual board member could have caught it and changed it.
No, I'm saying it. I'm sorry, but an individual board member gets a nice fat check.
They don't make that much.
You are a fiduciary.
I understand. I was one. I get it. You know.
By the way, I've been one. I understand what it means. Okay, and I took the obligation seriously. Because, at least in theory, this guy expected if I did this, I'd go to jail, all right? But the guy sitting on the corporate boards never go to jail.
All we're doing is I'm saying you need to do something.
Well, you're saying you need to do more.
We're arguing over the price of a hooker. We're both saying it's a hooker, right?
I'm just saying it needs to be a prison sentence.
Okay,
now,
whatever.
I want to point out where the... Why, when I saw this thing from CNBC, I looked at the MTS to try to fact check it and found, you know, what I found. Okay, then I dug through the rest of it because, you know, I kind of do that with the MTS all the time, right? All right. So last year, the tax input into CMS, remember, Medicaid is a pure welfare program. Right. There's no offsetting tax. Medicare, on the other hand, is not a pure welfare program.
Is there no Medicaid tax on the state level either? I should know.
No, what the states do is up to them, okay? But the block grants are from the federal government.
Right.
They cover about half, okay? The other half the states pay.
I have to believe that there's somehow a tax in Chicago for county hospital.
I don't, you know, I wouldn't be, well, I mean, you know, different states do different things, okay?
But those aren't those hospitals county, not state?
Yeah, in most cases they are, yeah. But so anyway, here's my point. The entire amount of tax collected, that's the Medicare part of FICA, okay?
Yep.
Approximately $300 billion last year. Which is not shocking. It's up a little from where it was the year prior, but that's about where it's been running, is right around that area. All right. This last fiscal year, CMS, across all of it, spent $2.485 trillion, actually, because it's 969. So, and by the way, last year, when Biden's last full year in office, it was 2.222. So almost, that's an increase, by the way, of 263, which is about 11%. It's about 11% escalation. All right. Incidentally, 263 is almost the entire amount of tax collected. So nearly all of this.
Oh yeah, it's terrible.
Was pure deficit add. Now here's the best part of this. All right, if you start going down this line, these line items, the state grants were up about $50,000. 668 versus 618. Okay, that's a big increase. The benefit payments from the hospitals, 440 versus 403. That's a 10% escalation.
Wow. Well,
all right.
We say that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, and oh, by the way, this keeps going. You know,
I think that you should go look at the CPI and find out you're all wrong.
Well, yeah, okay. you know, benefit payments under the supplemental, you know, which is the doc stuff, is 572 versus 520. Okay, so there's another 50, right?
It is outstanding. What's
by the
going
way,
on.
Prescription drugs, 163 versus
116. Biden was going to drop the price. So is Trump. Not one of them's down.
Now, not one of these numbers is down, and by the way, and they're not up a little.
Yeah.
Okay? They're effing huge. And so, and then, you know, the supplemental is, which this one is a monster, right? This is absolutely ridiculous. The total is up a plus 100. 741.5.
It's totally outrageous, and it's going to the same people. Hey, regarding the Arthur Anderson thing, just to go back to this, there's long-term consequences to this stuff, Carl. And if it was me, I would have found another way. I would have spanked him differently. Because now look forward. You had Big Eight, right? So now you subtract one, and now you let two or three others merge, and now we got four. Are we better off or worse off?
Well, okay. So you can say, all right,
because the one hand, they can't wait to throw the guys out of business. Then they let two other guys merge. Does anybody in this government talk to the other person ever? Well, it's like in Chicago. Does a guy know that he's shutting down one bridge, or another guy's shutting the bridge down next to it? Does any of these people, is there any competency anywhere?
Okay, but here's the thing, Chief. Let's say that the original action, which essentially destroyed Arthur Anderson, have stood. Okay? Let's just say that has stood. And then, in addition, the DOJ did not issue the formal guidance, which stands to this day, that we're not throwing criminal felony charges on large corporations because of the economic impact. We're not going to do it.
Well,
doesn't matter what they do, we're not going to do it. Now, that is literally formal written guidance within the Department of Justice.
I don't disagree. I don't.
Now, if they had not done that, All right? Would 2008 and all the things that came along with that, all the scams in the mortgage businesses, Zillow, for crying out loud, Countrywide.
Carol, all you got to do, how many times have you heard me rant and rave on Madigan? I don't know the man, he's no friend of mine, going to jail for allegedly taking a bribe, and the company that gave him the bribe still gets to keep
To keep the money.
They get to keep the increase in electricity costs, and all those guys are fine, except for the one lady that somehow became her fault.
Right.
Good Lord.
And so, and that's, it's one of the things that I've pointed out repeatedly is, last time I checked, giving a bribe is illegal too.
Yeah, plus not to mention my electric bill's higher because he was successful, guess what? But anyways, all right, real quick question. What? How bad? I mean, the VIX is down $1.40 this morning before the opening. We're still at 24, which is, it's not crash territory, but it's a serious warning. It's a serious warning.
Chief, I see the parallels. History does not repeat, but it rhymes. Okay? I see the parallels here. They're exactly the same thing that happened the last time. You had Bernanke, subprimes contained.
Yeah.
And, just two little hedge funds that these guys, these rich bastards that got out over their skis and they got their head cut off. Oh, so sad for them. But nothing is a big deal in the greater economy. Then Bear Stearns blows up, we hear the same thing. And oh, by the way, the market takes a nice big fat header on the day it happens. And then a week later, everything's fine. Buy the dip, buy the dip, buy the dip, buy the dip.
Yep.
And, the VIX went up a fair little bit, right? And then not too long after this. And by the way, the signs of trouble, things like, unpayable debts in various places and balance sheet games. I flagged them in the start of 2007 when WAMU reported earnings and was paying their dividend out of capitalized interest. All right, so.
Well, the guy in China is talking like he's got money too.
Well, of course, everybody is, right? So here's the thing. We have become a society in which the bigger the fraud, you may get fined, but you're not going to go to prison. And that was the root cause of the run-up and the blow-up in 2008.
Oh, without a doubt.
We're doing the same thing here. We got people in the AI field that are claiming amortization. I about fell out of my chair. These guys are claiming amortization schedules of 6 and 10 years on these GPUs and these other compute elements. I've been doing this stuff for 40 years, and there has never been a technology section of the economy where the useful service life of a piece of computing equipment has exceeded 24 months. Not once. And by the way, in switching...
Hey, my computer's 10 years old.
Well, I'm saying economic life.
Yeah.
I'm not saying service. Okay, it'll work.
Yep.
I've got computers here that are 10 years old that still work perfectly. That's not the point. The point is you can't make money with it anymore because the new model is cheaper, faster, uses less power. Okay, and therefore your competitor's going to buy the new one, not the old one. And if you don't, he's going to kill you.
I would agree. Hey, buddy, we got a dash. What do you got going this weekend? You going to any ball games?
No ball games, but I've got two. I've got a race tonight, and I got another one tomorrow morning.
Really?
So I'm being a little bit of a crazy person. My daughter roped me into the one tonight after I'd long since. And by the way, the big thing about the one tomorrow is we're finishing on the field at Neyland.
Really? What was it? 5K?
Yeah, and it's going to be a goat rodeo. It supposedly is the largest registration numbers ever posted up by the Knoxville Track Club, which I can believe given how crazed everybody is about the Vols and everything here. And the other thing that's really going to be interesting about it is that tomorrow's No King's Day, supposedly.
Oh, yeah.
So guess what? We're going to run into that sort of insanity in the middle of it, I suspect, afterwards anyway, although I don't think those people get up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Probably not. All right, but we'll run safe. SP Futures down 11, NASDAQ Futures down 93. We came all the way back, and now we're slinking again. It's going to be an interesting day, I feel, back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.